The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Transmission of the Light, Buddhamitra. Buddhanandi told Buddhamitra, "You are more akin to mind than your parents, incomparably more akin. When your actions accord with enlightenment, this is the mind of all Buddhas. If you seek a formal Buddha externally, it will bear no resemblance to you. If you want to know your original mind, it is neither together nor separate." Hearing this, Buddhamitra was greatly enlightened. Kazon's verse. "Do not say that words and silence touch upon the remote and subtle. How can there be material senses to defile inherent essence?" Good morning. I spent a week with my family down in North Carolina a week ago, so this koan sort of called to me. This collection put together by Kazon several generations after Dogen is said to be the enlightenment experiences of the lineage going, starting with the Buddha and ending with Ajo, Dogen's teacher, student. And particularly in the early, the Indian masters, at that time, records were not being kept. You know, people's stories were not really being put down. So a lot of this, I don't know where it comes from. The biographies of a lot of these early teachers is drawn from another collection called The Transmission of the Lamp, not the light, but the lamp, which was written about the year 1000 by a Chinese monk. And it was put together in a series of books, which is basically the Zen lineage, or certain lineages, rather, masters of certain lineages, and is drawn from whatever sources there are. So the biographies that show up in Kazon's collection are really drawn from Transmission of the Lamp. And the early ones in particular have a lot of magical qualities to them in terms of those the biographies. So it's said that Buddhamitra was lived with his parents and never spoke. And his teacher, Buddhanandi, had a vision that he would meet such a person. And so as they were traveling, he was traveling with his students, they came to a town, and he came to talk to a couple who said that they had a child who had never spoken, who was 50 years old. And Buddhanandi said, "If this is so, then this is the disciple I've been looking for." And so when Buddhamitra heard this, he bowed and asked of Buddhanandi, who was to be his teacher, saying, "My father and mother are not my kin. Who is most akin? The Buddhas are not my path. Whose is the most supreme path?" And Buddhanandi said, "You are more akin to mine than to your parents, incomparably more akin. When your actions accord with enlightenment, this is the mind of the Buddhas. If you seek a form of Buddha externally, it will bear no resemblance to you. If you want to know your original mind, it is neither together nor separate." And as Buddhamitra went on then, so parents out there who's you're worried about how your child is developing, they're 50 years old, they haven't spoken yet, they might just be a Zen master waiting to be discovered. And so as Buddhamitra was teaching, it said that whenever he would meditate, Mara would come and disrupt him, try and mess up his meditation. And so in order to deal with that, Buddhamitra took three corpses, the corpse of a dog and two other living things, and made a necklace out of them and sort of concealed them in flowers and made them as a gift to Mara, the devil, who received them very gratefully. And when Mara put them on, then they returned to their corpse-like state. And so freaked out, did not like this, couldn't take them off. And so he went up into heaven to consult with the gods and said, "Can you help me take this off? This is really gross." And the god said, if you want to get taken off, only Buddhamitra can do that. And the only way that that's going to happen is if you become his student. And so he went back and he asked to be his student, and Buddhamitra accepted him, and then the garland of corpses fell off. So that's another way to enter the path. So my mother and father are not my intimates, Buddhamitra said. Who is my true family? One's true family. The Buddha said to know, truly know anyone, we have to know ourselves. To understand this world, we have to know the self. We have to see the true self. And true here means before the arising of any sign, of any meaning, of any idea. The question, the koan, what is your original face, is asking this question. Hakuin's koan of the one hand, or Zhaozhou's mu, is asking this question. What is the true self? The Buddha realized that when the true self is seen, that the true nature of every living being has been seen. In Mahayana Buddhism, it's said that there are two realizations, fundamental realizations, that need to occur. One is the realization of the self. And then the other is the realization of things, phenomena, others. Because it's not enough from the Mayan perspective to just be liberated within ourselves, because we're interacting with the world all the time. And if we still impute into other things a sense of solidity or autonomy or independent existence, then they will have their own power and will still be deluded by that. And so both have to be seen through. And of course, historically, family in most cultures has been probably the strongest, closest, most connecting bond, for good and otherwise. And so to know one's family is to know one's people, right? Who are your people? There are cultures, I think in the Maori culture in New Zealand, where when two people meet for the first time, the way they greet each other is by basically chanting their lineage, letting each other know, who are you, is where do I come from? Who are my people? Who brought me into this life, and who brought them into their lives, and going back and back and back. And Buddhism has always taken root in countries where this was very important, right? A very dominant force and an influence, and carried obligations. This is extremely important in the life of the Buddha, in Confucian countries, China, Japan, Southeast Asia. And so to say my mother and father are not my kin is not to deny one's mother and father. It's not to deny or minimize the importance of family. It's asking a deeper question. To what am I most akin? Because even those that we're closest to, if we're close to our family, siblings, parents, so on, there's still distance. There's still two. And that all those relationships will pass, at least in their current form. The Buddha said everyone that we cherish in this life will pass away, or we will pass away from them. And so while family is our blood lineage, our ancestry, and is hugely significant in forming our identity, it's also our story, right? Where we come from is the story of my family. It's the story of my experiences, the story of my parents' experiences, and so on. A collection of stories that we use to define ourselves and others. Some of those stories are sweet, have happy endings, some of them are not. Some of them are virtuous, some of them are destructive and violent. So today we celebrated Juneteenth, which actually was on the 19th of this month, on Wednesday. So this was the time in 1865 when a Union general, went into Galveston, Texas, and informed the population, particularly the enslaved people, that the war had ended. It had ended 2 months earlier, at least Lee had surrendered the Union Army, or the Confederate Army, two months earlier. I've always thought about that in all of the terrible things about war, to think about when the war has actually ended, but not everybody knows yet, and they're still fighting and dying and killing. So the population didn't know. In fact, it said that there were enslaved people within that area that didn't even know that the Emancipation Proclamation had taken place 2 years earlier, which freed them as enslaved people. And that general read a statement that said, "This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. And I can't help to think that, the assumption was between white employers and black hired labor, and too early to know that that would necessarily need to change as well. And so that began a long entrenched history of resistance, particularly from white Southerners, black codes, Jim Crow laws, a retelling of the story of what the Civil War is actually even about, even though it's overly abundantly documented as being about slavery. When I was raised in Atlanta in the 60s and 70s, I was taught that the Civil War is about states' rights. That's what I believed for years and years. I knew that slavery was in there somewhere, but that the real reason was about states' rights, a retelling of the story. It made me think of a book by Clint Smith, African-American author, poet, who grew up in New Orleans and wrote a book called How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America, which is an excellent book. And he went to different parts of the country, mostly Southern, but also New York City, because they also wanted for the readers to be very clear that New York City actually, as if I'm remembering, was the second largest port for slaveries, for slave ships coming in. We tend to think of New York City as being maybe different. And one of the places he went to was Galveston, where Juneteenth happened, but he went to different places. And in the book, he says, and what he would do oftentimes was he went to a place where there were a lot of white Southerners sort of commemorating, celebrating the Confederacy and, you know, Southern culture, so on. And he would talk to people, right? He would talk to white Southerners, white sort of folks very supportive and sort of nostalgic about the Confederacy. And he said, so much of the story we tell about history is really the story that we tell about ourselves, about our mothers and our fathers and their mothers and their fathers, as far back as our lineages will take us. Throughout our lives, we are told certain stories, and they are stories that we choose to believe, stories that become embedded in our identities in ways that we are not always fully cognizant of. And of course, as Buddhists, that's profoundly significant. When we are not cognizant of something that is within us, then that thing has force and strength that is basically unchecked because we're not aware of it. So it dominates. It rules, in a sense. And so much of practice, and that's whether we're talking about our own karma, our personal narratives, family narratives, whether we're talking about social conditioning, because there are stories within stories within stories. And we hear them. And whether we like them or not, we hear them. And we can identify as that's me, or we can identify as that's not me. Both of those are different aspects of an identity. But if we're not aware of it, then it will continue to have strength and exert force on us and come out. So that's why so much of Buddhist practice necessitates, requires, mandates, I would say, that we become aware of what we have not been aware of, which is one of the most challenging things about practice. From within a dream, how do you realize you're dreaming? How do we open our eyes when our eyes are still closed? He goes on to say, for many of the people that he met in this particular place where he was talking to these white sort of Confederacy sympathetic people, he said, the story of the Confederacy is the story of their home, of their family, and the story of their family is the story of them. So when they are asked to reckon with the fact that their ancestors fought a war to keep his ancestors, Clint's ancestors, enslaved, there is resistance to facts that have been documented by primary sources and contemporaneous evidence. So the story meets reality. What then happens, right? There's going to be resistance. It's threatening. And when any of us who have been involved in trying to undo the internalized aspects of any form of bias, of racism or gender or sexual orientation or class or whatever it might be, when that reality within ourselves, that story we've been told and that we've taken on as our own and may not even be aware of and identify with, that's who I am, meets a reality that challenges that, it feels like a threat. It can feel like an existential threat. So when we look and see what's happening, not just in our own country, but in the world, right? That sort of deep, primordial kind of fight for life, as though one's life is being threatened. It's the sense of self. He says people are then forced to confront the lies that they have upheld. They're forced to confront the flaws of their ancestors, right? It's like, I can talk about the flaws of my parents, but you can't do that, right? That's not all right. And he quotes somebody, a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, who was interviewed by the New York Times after the 2015 Charleston massacre. And he said, you're asking me to agree that my great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents were monsters. And that's part of the problem, is it becomes very binary. That it sounds as though what he's being asked to accept is that the people that he thought were wonderful are now monsters. One or the other. Right? That's what makes it any kind of progress untenable. Who wants to have to make that choice? Whereas if we realize that we are vast and contain the multitude, we can act in a monstrous way, and we can also act in a loving way. We can be caring and uncaring, be compassionate and cruel, right? Be clear and cloudy. Clint says, accepting such a reality would for them mean the deterioration of a narrative that has long been a part of their lineage and the disintegration of so much of who they believed themselves to be in the world. If I'm not this, then who am I? So much of the story we tell about history is about ourselves. Personal stories, family stories, stories of different identity groups, national stories, stories that are true, stories that are false, stories that are true and false. And so that's why in practice, as we essentially uncover these stories, it's not about just getting rid of the bad ones and writing new ones. It's about finding a life beyond the story. Because any story is going to be a story about someone, about something, from some perspective, about some time and place. There will be an investment. And so Buddhanandi said, you are more akin to mind, infinitely more akin than to your own family, to anything else. And so, of course, this raises the question, what is mind? What is that which we are most intimate with? In moments when the self arises, when we're feeling threatened and we react in a defensive way, or we're feeling affirmed, right? And so we tend to gather with people who affirm, who make us feel good, who affirm our own sense of ourselves. We do that in kind. It's kind of a natural thing to do. But when that's all that we do, then it becomes, right, a cocoon. It becomes a tunnel. And that self is just being affirmed and reaffirmed over and over again, being strengthened, solidified. And what Buddhanandi is saying is that all the while we're actually more akin to something that can't lie. Because it's not telling a story. It's not the truth because it's not a thing. It doesn't belong to you because it doesn't exist anywhere. And yet it's the nature of everything. Avalokiteshvara realizes mind. All beings have one essence. And that essence, we call it Buddha nature, we call it emptiness. That essence is without any essence. It's not a thing. You know, it's not like we go through all of the flotsam and jetsam and get to one bright, shining pearl which exists, which is. The Buddha realized there is no thing in the center of anything. And that's why Buddhism takes up this question so centrally, so ardently, what is mind? And so in the beginning, in a sense, we're looking at that from the perspective of the mind that arises, thoughts, emotions, memories, stories, reactions, because that's what's dominating, right? That's what's sort of taking up all the space. That's what I am. Why is it so hard for me to let go of? Because that's what I identify with. That's why attachments are hard to let go of. It's not just because they're habits, like a blind thing. It's a potent thing. Right? Attachment is a potent thing. It's me. It's who I am. It's how I see myself. It's how I want you to see me. It's how I am in the world. It's how I know what is and isn't. So it naturally, it's going to be hard to let go of that, even if I want to. And so this very clear, insistent, penetrating inquiry into the nature of mind, that which we are most akin to, that which never lies, cannot be corrupted, will never betray, from which you will never part. Because it's unchanging. It's not a thing, which means you also can't possess it. If you could, it would betray you, because it would be a thing. Nothing is outside of this mind. We think of mind as our head, our brain, maybe it's our thoughts and ideas, our awareness, consciousness. Nothing is outside of mind, but mind is not any of those things itself. Being distant from mind is to be distant from our true self, our true nature, which I think is why when we begin practicing and just stop and start turning towards, even if there's a whole lot of stuff going on, right? And any sense of clarity or calmness or serenity or stability seems miles away, even just in turning towards, I think if we pay attention, there's a sense of something, that we are in the midst of something that is true. Something that is trustworthy. And so when we're upset or angry or sad, we may think that it's our mind that is upset or angry or sad. But the mind is always clear. The fundamental mind is always clear. It's undisturbed. It's spacious. It's boundless. It's unhindered. And so there are so many teachings that try and convey the nature of this mind. Somebody asked Bodhidharma, in the record of Bodhidharma, why is it said that all dharmas are neither existing nor non-existent? So the question is, what about dharmas? Do they exist or do they not exist? And Bodhidharma answers saying, the mind substance is without substance. The question is about dharmas, and Bodhidharma answers with mind. The mind substance is without substance. The nature of mind is free of anything. It is the Dharma substance. Mind is formless, and so it is not existence. But it also functions ceaselessly. And so it's not non-existent. Because it functions, yet is constantly empty, it is not existence. Because it is empty and yet constantly functions, it is not non-existence. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. And this is so essential in the teachings. Because if it was just empty, then nothing, everything would be empty, nothing would matter, and it'd be nihilistic. If it just existed, which is basically the view of our deluded mind, then everything exists separate and distinct. What I do over here doesn't matter, but what happens over here. I was just reading, there was an excellent piece in the Times this morning about the resumption, potential resumption of nuclear testing. Like we need more tests of nuclear warheads, infinitely more, well, much more powerful than the ones that were dropped on Japan. And the article was really about what has happened to all the people who lived even within hundreds of miles of these places where these tests were occurring. Illness, death, destruction, but we need more. Bodhidharma says, mind is no mind. Because mind is no mind, it is called the Dharma mind. Today's practitioners understand this as the destruction of all delusions. A delusion, the only way something could be destroyed is if it existed in some way that it or its parts could be extinguished, which makes sense from our deluded mind when we think, well, things exist inherently. But what the Buddha realized is things only exist in a constant, ceaseless, ongoing state of change. Nothing ever is. Nothing ever has any sense of permanence or soul or eternality. Mind is like space. It's indestructible. Therefore, it's called the thunderbolt mind. It does not abide in abiding, nor does it abide in non-abiding. And therefore, it is called the mind of insight. So, reading these texts, it can just seem like, why do you make this so complicated? You say it's not this, but it's not this. Exactly. In the Majjhimaka school, it's called a non-affirming negation, kind of a technical term for saying, by pointing to something as being spacious and boundless, it has to at the same time not affirm something else. Right, and it's really just pointing to how wily our minds are and how persistent it is. Well, okay, it's not this, but it's got to be that. I'll let go of this, but can I have this instead? Okay, I'll let go of the self, but there's still something there, right? I think that's why rebirth is so commonly misunderstood as, oh, I get to come back. There is no I that lives and dies and returns. That's what the Buddha realized. That's our liberation. What is it that feels threatened when we encounter a truth that challenges our story of ourself? Me. I'm being threatened. Which is why it's wonderful practice in those moments when we're responding that way. And it can happen in just any moment. Somebody's offering you some helpful criticism, right? And they try and make it easy. So they say 10 things about you that are wonderful. And then they say one thing about you, right, that is critical. And that's all you remember. It's existential, right? I mean, it happens when we come into practice. We have all kinds of ideas about this. And then we start to meet the reality. Can we yield? Can we yield and let go of that which we thought was true or that we thought this is? If not, there's going to be a struggle. There is a struggle. Check it out. See what's happening. And really, you know, in a way, this is just another way of saying that with practice, we will be uncomfortable. We could pretty much put that on the door. We can promise you one thing. You will be uncomfortable. And that's not new. It won't be the first time. So why? What's the difference? Your eyes are opening. That's the difference. And we now can begin to examine, well, what is discomfort? What is that? The Buddha said in the Foundations of Mindfulness, how does a student remain focused within their meditation on feelings, sensations? He says, there's the case where a student, when feeling a painful feeling, discerns, I am feeling a painful feeling. And when feeling a pleasant feeling, they discern, I am feeling a pleasant feeling. And it's not that, you know, we're trying to define it or create a narrative. It's just recognizing this is an uncomfortable feeling. That's it. That's all he said. He didn't say, now form an opinion about it, figure out what you're going to do about it, go to war against it. It's pleasant. Hold on to it and keep it forever. He said, there's just a discernment. This is uncomfortable. That's it. Which is shorthand for saying, avoiding the impulses of denying, suppressing, redirecting, going to sleep, or getting embroiled in a story. This is why I'm uncomfortable. Whose fault is this anyway? And the Buddha is saying, there is, though that never ends, right? We should know that by now, right? Those never end. There's always somebody to blame. And so what the Buddha is saying, there is another way, and it's a revolution. Do not push it away. Do not hold it tightly. Do not hate it. Do not love it. Do not try to make it end. Don't actively keep it going. It's really no different from what Bodhidharma was saying, in a way, just in more technical language. It's not existent. It's not non-existent. How do you actually practice that? This is how. I am feeling a painful feeling, that's all. Can we leave it at that? Can we leave it just with that? And that's why, you know, the work that we do within the Beyond Fear of Differences is so important, because it's so profoundly a Dharma practice of facing internalized narratives, identities, attachments, racism, gender, sexual orientation, class, age. It seems almost endless, humans' capacity to put each other into categories, right? Based on some characteristics that are then imputed or solidified into having absolute qualities. And when we experience that discomfort, to not move away, to not blame, to not fix, to realize, as Bodhidharma said, it is without substance. And that's why it's so important in Zazen that we enter into freely, we enter into stillness, right? Which is itself, in our culture, not a small thing, and silence. And we bring that to ourselves, we allow that, we realize we have the capacity for that. And sometimes it takes a little bit of discipline because we're restless, we're itchy, right? We're not used to not responding to every little thing. And so there's a discipline of that. And it's really important to understand how powerful that is. What it allows us to work through, which means there are moments where we're going to be uncomfortable. You know, but it's a manageable discomfort, right? Nobody's life is on the line. No real harm is being done. It's just an everyday, ordinary, slight moment of irritation or discomfort. And that's why I say it's important. Practice the small things, right? So when you have an itch in Zazen, you don't scratch it. Practice that, because you're learning how to experience a discomfort that's physical, so it's very close to you, right? And the principle of that, the essence of that, is not different at all than when you're experiencing a much more profound discomfort. You're ill, you're injured, you're dying. We're training to live. Your mind is completely akin to you. And so the more we come into and turn towards and begin to enter into the natural state of mind, Buddha mind, original mind. So that's why that question, what is your original face, the face you had before your parents were born? The face that wasn't given to you by your parents. And of course, it's not just talking about this. It's talking about our basic nature. And it's natural, sort of inevitable, to think that that things around us are causing us discomfort and, you know, dis-ease and pain and suffering. And that's why Buddhism is very grounded. It says, yeah, if there's anything you can do about that, to ameliorate that, by all means. Let's make our lives work better, and for everyone. Of course we should do that. But if we're wholly reliant on that, because we can do that and still be creating suffering, in fact, that's sort of the norm. We solve the problem, but something is still not resolved. Everything is fine, but something is not. And so that's why we spend the morning sitting on this cushion, together, turning inward, trying to get to the basis, to come into contact with that to which we are most akin to. You know, it's really helpful and important when we sit. You know, for some people, it's just hard to develop a steady practice. That's legitimate, so work on that, you know. If you want to have a steady practice, on certain days you sit, you're making certain choices. On other days, you're not sitting. You make different choices. If you want to sit more regularly, notice those choices, right? What gets in the way? I was talking to somebody a while back, and they were talking about how they had fallen off their morning practice. And I said, well, what do? And they said, well, I get up, I make a cup of coffee, I sit down to drink my coffee, I read the paper. I said, don't read the paper. I mean, come on. Because he said, and then I look up and it's like, oh, I've run out of time. Right? Sometimes it's not that complicated, but we got to notice. But when we're sitting, if we've gotten to that point where we're able to sit more regularly, that then in a way becomes a habit. Not a bad habit. But it's something that we don't have to work so hard to do, which is kind of the nature of a habit. But to then be intentional. So that we don't just sort of show up on the seat because I showed up there yesterday. This is the time when I show up on this seat. And then I just keep going, blathering away. And so that you sit on that seat and really recognize, I am here to do Zazen. This is important. Right? And try and make contact with why it's important. Raise Bodhi mind. Recognize how important this is in your life. How does it affect your day? What is it that this path is calling to you about? And that grounds us. It puts us in that seat, on that seat. So now we're actually ready, right? And it's much easier than to ground ourselves, redirect the mind. At the end of this chapter that I was reading from on How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith, he said, I'm left wondering if we are all just patchworks of the stories we've been told. What would it take, what does it take, for you to confront a false history, even if it means shattering the stories you've been told throughout your life, even if it means having to fundamentally re-examine who you are and who your family has been? Just because something is difficult to accept doesn't mean we should refuse to accept it. Just because someone tells us a story doesn't mean that the story is true. And I think what practice shows us is that when we don't face what is true because it's difficult, it gets harder. We do that because we think it's going to protect us from something that's difficult or that it's too much. I can't do this. It's overwhelming. It's not time yet. And it gets harder. When we turn towards it, we realize we can do that. I have that capacity. And whatever I thought that was going to be, that turning towards, it's not. It's not an idea of something. It's just a facing. Because what we're facing is not a problem that needs to be fixed. It's not a history that needs to be corrected. History is just stories of things that have happened that are gone, done. We can't go back. The way was it Milarepa who said that the reward is to live and die without regret? That when we turn away, we know we're turning away. And that stays with us. And that's a heavy burden. When we turn towards, that burden is lightened. Because our lives are lightened. Our capacity increases. We realize what we're actually made of. More than just patchworks of stories. So I'll end with a poem There's a glorious mountain far in the distance that calls to me, a golden halo, an eternal paradise, a world far beyond. This dream, is it mine or yours? Is it true or false? The mountain, the world, the dream, the true, the false, is mine. What more is there to say?
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.